is simply just, who is Dr. Anna Elise Anderson? What are your roots? Can you just share a little bit of your backstory with us?
Yes. So first and foremost, y'all can definitely, we can just go by Rihanna or even Riri, because to know me is to know, I have many nicknames and Riri is one of them. But I would say, yeah, to know me really is just to know about Detroit. Like if you know anything about Detroit, if you have met a Detroiter, we are incredibly prideful people. We love our city very much. And we will fight to the bottom of the map just to say, like, you're not going to disrespect us. You're not going to talk about any of the problems we have. Because that's like an in-house thing. Like, you can talk to your family about it, but you can't talk, you know, about it to other people. So we are very prideful people who really just love our city and love it fiercely. So that's like a major takeaway for me. I say that I am born in, raised for, and returned to Detroit. And that has been a theme for me throughout my life, to know that everything that I do was because of my city, and everything I will do is for my city. And those are some of the ethos that drive my work to this day. I'm someone who very much so loves fiercely. I love my community, friends, family so much. And I love Black people in a way that it just, everything that I do at the heart of it is for the improvement of our well-being. And I think the last tagline I'll say is that throughout my work, I've had this focus on acknowledging that Black lives matter. So the movement is absolutely important. And as a psychologist, I actually beg the question about Black life mattering as well. So the quality of the life that we lead and we live has to matter as well. We can't just say that folks need to be alive, because if people are alive and facing disparities and inequities that are shortening the lives that we live, or shortening the quality, reducing the quality of the education or the income or our general health and well-being, then that's not a life that I would want to live either. So I always support this idea that Black life matters as well. And that's who the heck I am.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to go ahead and go to the next question.
Love that. And I was just going to just say one little tidbit. Your love definitely shines through your work. Aww. If you aren't already following her, get your life. She's a mover and shaker in our world. But I was going to talk about, so can we talk about this fighting against feelings deep within when you know it's the right move? So I read in a former interview that you telling the story of fighting the call to return back home to your roots. Detroit. What was the defining moment for you that prompted your return to do this work where you grew up, and how has this decision shaped your mission to serve?
Woo. All right. I'm not going to try to cry on today. That my goal is not a midday cry, but yeah.
It's okay. It's okay to cry, because Darian will let you know I'm the crier on the show.
Sure,
let me get my tissue. You thank you for the warning.
We do cry count.
Well, good. We are family then. We are related. Excellent. We were talking before the show about the life of an academic. And I think a lot of people, when they hear the word professor, shoot, even I, when I was in undergrad, I had no idea what a professor was or did. And I just thought all they did was teach all day. And there are certain schools or certain levels of being a professor that might be the case. In my case, I'm very research intensive and research heavy. And so when you're applying for positions or jobs, people will literally apply everywhere. And I always throw Iowa and Idaho under the bus. I don't mean to do that, but honestly, just in my life, there would never be a moment where I would say, I desire to live in the great state of Idaho. No shade, just saying, that's just my experience. So when you think about academics, they apply up, down, left, right, middle, big, you know, just any institution to become an academic, because it's actually really quite hard to get our positions oftentimes. So I'm sharing that because God really graced me and blessed me when it was time for me to look for a job with a variety of opportunities. And some of them fit this like Goldilocks model of, you know, too close, too far, just right. Like I had really a bevy of opportunities. But within that Goldilocks model, there was home. So there was University of Michigan School of Public Health. There was this like dream oasis of University of Southern California out in LA, like, you know, and I'll come back to that in a second. And then a third school, which I won't share at this moment, but I had this opportunity to really think about, do I want to go all the way out there? This place I've always wanted to be, LA. I wanted to apply to USC when I was in undergrad and couldn't afford it. And now they're telling me that they're going to bring me out and pay me, like, wow, what a full, you know, circle moment. Or do I go back home to a place where I know in the depths of my spirit I'm supposed to go? And when I was making that evaluation, I thought to myself, well, if God is giving me the opportunity to go out to LA and God knows the desires of my heart, then I have to take this opportunity because I don't know when I'll have it again. So I chose to go out to LA to be a professor at USC. And again, in the same way that the academy is a hard place to get into, it's also shrouded with politics. So I'm not going to talk in depth about what was happening at USC, but I knew quickly that it wasn't the right place for me. And I was so confused. I looked up to God and I said, didn't you tell me to go out here? Isn't this what I was supposed to be doing? I prayed, I fasted, I asked my pastor, I did all this. Like, wasn't this, and you gave me the desires of my heart. Isn't that what you said you wanted me to do? And so to answer the question on how I knew I needed to come back, there were two really pivotal moments. One was that I came back for one of my best friend's weddings in Detroit in October of that year. So a few months after I had moved out, and just being home brought actual tears to my eyes. I was just aching to come home. And again, this was October. This was a particularly like dreary and gray weekend. And here I am living in LA with like little drop top, you know, sports car, living downtown, drinking juice, doing yoga, like everything I've ever wanted to do, right, in my life, and feeling unfulfilled because I wasn't working on behalf of Black families the way that I knew I could have back in Michigan. And not being supported in the way that I needed to do to launch my career the way that it needed to go. So that was moment one where I physically just felt a pull back to Detroit. And the second was a sermon at the church that I was attending in LA. And I tried to do this super quick for y'all. But the sermon was the pastor asked, who here considers themselves an entrepreneur? Now in Los Angeles, California, that is 93% of everyone. Cause they're like, I'm my manager, I'm my agent. You know, they're everything for themselves. So all these right. hands flew up, right? But then I started thinking about it like, well, you've at this point created this therapeutic strategy for Black families. And we'll get into that later, but you've created this program called Embrace. You essentially have developed a logo. You have to hire a staff. You have a website. You have made a business unknowingly, right? Like you don't, in the academy, we don't talk about it like that, but I unknowingly created a business. So I was like, tentatively raised my hand. And then the pastor asked, what did God tell you about that dream of being this entrepreneur early on? What was the dream associated with this? And a flood of memories just came back in about how in the third grade, I drew this picture of something called the Kid Dome. And it was an inner city Detroit children's center that would serve the Black children in my community, that I worked on this vision with the Detroit City Council as a high school student, interned with the council to create this place, mm-hmm. had said I was going to come back and do this. And somehow, after, you know, 8 years of the academy, hopping from place to place, getting trained and you know, learning how to do this work, I lost sight of it. I lost the vision. And that day I walked out of church saying, I have to get back to Michigan, you know, come heck or high water. Like I got to get home. And again, God showed out by allowing me to take a job at the University of Michigan, the place I had declined the year before. And these jobs don't just come up, right? They're not like bountiful. They, you know, once something closes, that's that. So it had been filled But God created a job, and the person who gave me my job, my chair of my department, said, "This has your name on it," when she offered it to me. She said, "It's not an open position. If you take it, it's yours. If you don't take it, it's no one is filling this. This is yours." And that language that God has spoken, you know, in to people who follow, you know, the word, that when something is yours, it doesn't matter what you have done. You could have fallen short time and time again. You could have made a mistake. You could have declined, as I did, you know, an opportunity. But if something has your name on it, and if it's yours, it is yours. Mm-hmm. And coming back home has opened up a world of opportunity and has launched me in a way that you would think staying in LA would have, like being close to media and being able to be on camera. Like, that is what I thought was going to happen out in LA. And I thought being home in Detroit was going to stifle that opportunity coming back home.
Wow. That's just an amazing story. I think God, sometimes in his sovereignty, you know, he has things already laid out and planned for you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just so funny. Have you ever thought about the fact that maybe the only reason you went to LA for that short season was for you to be in that seat that day for that pastor to bring back for those memories to flood you again?
Yes, absolutely. And once I recognized, like, you had to go there to come back here, like once I learned that storyline, things started to unlock. Like, it's a longer story than we have time for today, but sure. After I was praying and fasting and I wasn't hearing anything from God, I'm like, how are you just going to leave me to go to LA? How are you not going to talk to me? I don't understand what's going on. When God and I typically have a very communicative relationship. Yeah. But after that service, after that sermon, after my understanding that I needed to come back, God told me three things like that were going to happen in a given week. They all happened. And it made our connection stronger to say, like, I will never leave you. Never. Mm-hmm. You don't even know how much I protect you and cover you, because if you really want to see what bad is, I will remove my protective cover. If you want to see what it really looks like. But you experiencing a bump or a bruise or a storm is not me not covering you. I'm always there. So that's what that was. Yeah, for sure.
Gianna, you have ministered to this. No, I appreciate that, because this actually wasn't a plan. But it happened the way it's supposed to happen. So
yeah,
I'm so grateful of you sharing this story. Yeah, I'm gonna just keep it, 'cause I want to cry.
We don't mind ever having church around here, it is quite interesting. We were not expecting to have church today.
We can stay. But, you know, that is something, right? Because, you know, folks in the academy definitely don't talk about God. Like, you don't hear about what God does to researchers and academics a lot. So that is something that I am very clear about, like the impact of God on my life. So thank you for giving me the space to talk about that.
Absolutely. Anytime. Love that. But let's talk about the work that you have dedicated yourself to, which evolves around the study and impact of racial discrimination and socialization in Black families. Can you share with us your experience growing up Black and how that influenced you, if at all, your decision to pursue this particular topic in your field of studies and work?
Yeah, so I always like to just reverse just a bit, because when we talk about socialization, I think that's just like, what? Now, what is this word that y'all are talking about? Like, what is this thing? Colloquially, we call that the talk. And it's perfectly timed, because as we're taping this, the last night, the debate had a question from a Black moderator on the talk and why that should be something that folks engage in. And we saw a range of responses to that, which I'm going to leave at the side of my table. I will not bring it up today. But anyway, we've got folks who have conversations with Black children about the discrimination that they are expected to face in the world around them. And that's this idea of socialization. So for me, growing up, even though we got a taboo strong family, we also have a very Afrocentric family who talk quite a bit about what the joy is first and foremost of being Black. So having a strong foundation in culture, in pride of our people knowing who we are and what our capabilities are, and also very clearly pointing to some of the challenges that may come at the quote expense of being Black. So I, as a mixed woman, biracial woman growing up in Detroit, had a very interesting bird's eye view into two different communities. And I've always called myself the bridge. I'm someone who has learned how to navigate not only in those two worlds, but between those two worlds of Black and white. And now as a researcher and community member. So someone who chose to come back to Detroit and now lives, you know, 45 minutes or an hour away from her university, but is making a very clear decision to be in spaces where you have to know how to navigate what is actually happening to people. Not to say that you can't live on a, you know, in a college city, but like, I want to know what experiences folks around me are having, in the same way that when I was growing up, to know what it was like to face discrimination when you didn't even fully grasp what discrimination was. So one thing that I think about all the time is the plexiglass in between, you know, consumer and the tellers at corner stores, right? Mm-hmm. So I grew up like that's just what it was. Like if that's the only model that you've ever seen is that you got to put your money through this little thing or this, you know, you put your foods through this conveyor, you know, I don't know, Lazy Susan, you know, device, like you're trained to know that this is what the world looks like. And you don't know that it doesn't look like that for everyone until you leave that world. So again, I would go to maybe my white father's side of town or, you know, when I've left Detroit and lived in different cities, I've seen like, oh, there aren't bulletproof glass dividers in between everybody. Yeah. That's not a, you know, it's not an expectation. Or something even, you know, someone pointed out on Twitter recently about like the products that are locked up in certain maybe CVSs or whatever, like, you know, hair products or condoms, things of that sort, that there's a concern around what people are going to take. Those everyday discriminatory experiences were things that we faced all the time growing up in Detroit, but didn't have the word or the understanding for when I was growing up. But I faced it quite a bit. And again, because I had that the dual life, I was able to navigate these different worlds. It brought this acuity for me very quickly that things were very different depending on which parent I was with or which side of town I was on. So those were some of the experiences that helped me to think about how do children who experience these barrage of negative experiences and resources that are deprived from them, like how do these kids navigate the world and how do families play a role in that navigation? So that's a pretty like large scale idea of what drove me to think about the type of work that I'm doing today.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I like the way that you frame that because, you know, the talk, it is, you know, when most people, when they think of that word, the talk, they think of something different, but it is something that in Black communities, that's just something that just happens in general. Our viewpoint of like the Black experience and things and preparing for what life may be like for us. So goes into my next question. On our show, Terry and actually, and I have had several conversations around this kind of ideal around race and talking to our children. We have different experts on raising anti-racist children to transracial families. A lot of things that we hear is that these families don't necessarily have the talk. They want to opt out of this dialogue with younger children due to exposing them too early. That's such a thing. Can you share from your you know, aspect, your psychological viewpoint and everything, and even your personal experience, how this form of overprotection of avoiding this conversation or the work around this topic can impact the child and how this possibly can contribute to unhealthy patterns, you know, as they continue to grow up?
Yeah. So I typically think about it. It's in the same spirit, but it's a slightly different way of getting to it. So we talk a lot in my work about this idea of airplanes. And you might ask, what on God's green earth does an airplane have to do with what we just talked about? Well, back in the day when we could get on flights, I don't know if you remember those times, but when we could get on flights, you were told as soon as you were about to get off or take off what you needed to do in case the plane was going to a fiery crashing death. And I always thought to myself, would I be engaging in those practices that they told me to do while we were calm and confident? Or would I be screaming up and down, you know, the aisleways trying to figure it out? But there's a reason that they tell you what to do, even when you're calm and even when you're about to zone out and not listen to this person giving you this instruction. There's a reason that they tell you what to do every single time to keep you safe. So the work that we do actually has pulled out some interesting statistics. In the year 2019, more Black people were killed at the hands of police officers than who died in airplane crashes worldwide. So in the United States, more Black people were killed at the hands of police. And that's one system. We're talking about police only. We are not talking about things like the novel COVID-19 pandemic that's certainly going to be a factor this year. We're not talking about freezing to death in a home because you didn't have air conditioning or heat or, facing your death because of not having air conditioning. We're not talking about any other system. We're talking about policing only took more Black people in one country than airplanes did the whole of the earth. Mm. I share that because we think it's okay to talk to people about safety precautions every single time they get on planes worldwide because we know that it keeps people safe. And yet we want to try to use the argument that we don't want to talk to our kids about race, even though it happens at a more frequent rate. Racial incidents that take life happen at more frequent rates than do the thing that we're prepared to talk about every day or every time we get on that plane. So the that's how I get to it. And the way that I talk about that then is that that's a misnomer. It stress research teaches us that you have to expose people at least incrementally to the stress or to the stressor so that they know what to do with it. You would not say, let LeBron just go ahead and play next year. He doesn't have to warm up today or practice today. You would never say that. You would not say, just get on a plane and when it goes down to a fiery crash, you'll figure out what to do about it. That's not what we would say about highly stressful situations. We know that it's important to expose at least to some degree so that people know what to do with it and know how to cope with it. So that's what racial socialization or the talk is all about. We're going to expose, we're going to tell kids the truth. We're going to do it in a developmentally appropriate way. So no, you're not going to want to tell them, like give them Alex Haley roots when they're 5 years old. That doesn't make sense. But you also don't want them to get to where they're experiencing interpersonal discrimination or racism, because again, they're already facing it, right? They're facing it every day. They have plexiglass in front of them when they go to the store. They have schools that are underfunded. They have houses that are not close to the resources that they need. They're already living in racism from utero. So we're talking interpersonal discriminatory experiences that can happen to them starting, you know, very early on. We don't want that to be their first exposure to it, because your child is going to essentially be in a fiery crashing plane, not knowing what